local preparations for coronavirus and the latest on testing here in Florida. New rules now are in place for local strip clubs. Yes, strip clubs. And the JEA board will decide the fate of some controversial contracts. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, a live report from the Amelia Island Concours Delegants. That's coming up. But first, it's Friday. Here to discuss a very busy week in the news, we welcome freelance writer Nikisha Williams. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mike Mendenhall of the Jax Daily Record.
Morning, Melissa.
And on the phone from Georgia, where she's covering a trial, Ann Schindler of First Coast News. Hey, Ann.
Hey, Melissa.
So good to have you all with us. And lots to talk about this week in the news. But we're going to begin with the story at the top of everyone's minds right now, Florida's response to coronavirus. The CDC has confirmed the fourth case of COVID-19 here in Florida. We're also told that there are 69 patients awaiting test results. One of them is a local woman whose story is posted on our website. 48-year-old Melissa, who asked that her last name be withheld, says that even though Memorial Hospital told her it can't rule out that she has COVID-19, two separate ER doctors told her she didn't qualify for a test because she hadn't traveled out of the country. When she called the Duval County Health Department, someone told her she would not be eligible for a test unless she takes a turn for the worse and is hospitalized. This brings up so many questions about how the state of Florida and the nation is handling testing for coronavirus. We're going to begin the hour with your calls and discussion. It's 549-2937 to join us. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And please weigh in on Facebook. Ann Schindler, let's start with you. You're up in Georgia where they're also conducting testing for coronavirus. But there have been so many questions about testing, concerns about the number of test kits that will be available, people feeling that they should be tested and can't get tested. It's not reassuring anxious residents out there, is it?
I mean, it is. And I, you know, just covering this trial, you realize how many things won't pass the crowd test, you know, just jury selection and, you know, passing around documents, people shoulder to shoulder. I mean, just the routine contact that we're so accustomed to starts to feel like a risk, you know. And I was reading this morning about how Texas is trying to deal with, you know, the influx of people for South by Southwest, you know, hundreds of thousands of people all coming to cram into clubs and cram into movie theaters and do meet and greets. It's, you know, there's so many layers that it's going to start impacting gets to the level that it has in other places. And I think that there's a greater sense that that's happening because there's so many people that have been wanting tests, and these rules that have limited who has access to those tests now seem like maybe not the wisest thing.
Right. You know, the Duval County Health Department is one of three around Florida, Nikisha, that is now conducting testing. But we definitely need more information about who's eligible for a test. How accessible are the tests? There are a lot of concerned people out there. Colleges and universities are taking steps to deal with the disease. They're asking people returning to campus from overseas to isolate themselves. The Duval County Public Schools has announced its protocol for coronavirus.
Yeah, I think it's the timing is so interesting because, you know, we have this national headline making communicable disease coming around at the same time that it's flu season. So the same thing that people are saying during flu season, wash your hands, cover your mouth, don't cough into your hands, be clean, be aware of your surroundings. It's the same things that they're saying for the coronavirus when they don't really have an idea of really how it's spread besides person to person and in the air, mm-hmm. and how to test for it, how to vaccinate for it, if there can be a vaccine for it. So this seems to be just a lot of unknown. And I think it's a dereliction of duty for hospitals or medical professionals to say, we won't test you for something when you don't even know what they have. Like, you wouldn't tell someone who said if they were presenting flu symptoms that you wouldn't test them for it or try to treat them. So to say that you wouldn't test them for COVID-19 when you don't even know how they got it, where they've been, or how or who they've come in contact with, because we don't know the impact of the spread. It just seems reckless to me.
It's 549-2937 to join us. Mike Mendenhall, the woman we interviewed whose story is up at WJCT.org, moved here recently from Portland, Oregon. And that's why she has more of a concern, because there are more confirmed cases on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and, you know, even domestic travel, if you're coming, you know, if you're going to and from a state where there's more confirmed cases or more suspected cases, that should you know, give that person pause. And and it's gonna continue to have an impact on ancillary things. You know, as far as the economy goes, we've seen volatility in the stock market, and just due to the concern about manufacturers not being able to get stuff from their suppliers, and as far as how it'll impact spending on travel. So, you know, there are a lot of things that, you know, moving down the road that we really could see continued impacts, even if we start to be able to contain and control the virus.
Here's an email on our Facebook page from Susan. I received an email. Medicare Part B covers a test to see if you have coronavirus. This test is covered when your doctor or healthcare provider orders it. If you get the test on or after February 4th, you will pay nothing for Medicare-covered clinical diagnostic lab tests. That's good to hear, and thank you for that. And Schindler, that said, the big story around the country, not just in Florida, is there aren't enough tests to determine who might have this disease, and there might be more infected than we know.
That's right. I think that we're hearing that now from the vice president himself, you know, acknowledging that there just aren't enough tests to accomplish what they believe needs to be accomplished. And, you know, spinning off what Mike was saying, I mean, the tourism impact in Florida is almost a bottomless well of potential. You know, there was an article in today's paper in St. Augustine that this is the start of festival season. There's going to be a festival every weekend now going forward. And, I mean, that and the cruise ship industry and Disney, I mean, is probably the biggest destination for international tourism in Florida. So there really are a lot of attendant impacts that people in the service industry and in tourism jobs could start experiencing sooner than later.
That's such a good point. You know, some festivals in Florida have been canceled. Nikisha, the Ultra Festival in Miami is being canceled due to concerns about coronavirus. Yesterday, we interviewed the executive director of the Players Championship. Mm. That is going forward as scheduled. In a few minutes here on this show, we'll get a live report from the Amelia Island Concours d'Elegance. That is going on as scheduled. So at least in our area, we're not seeing widespread cancellations. That could change. Because as Ann pointed out, people coming into Florida from all over the world, our situation here, our tourism-based economy is a little different than some states.
Yeah, but to Ann's point, mentioning Disney, I'm all for, organizations being cautious and taking accountability to keep people safe. But I feel like some of this is panic, and I'm not saying that it's unwarranted panic, but I feel like some of this is panic because I think I'll take it really seriously when Disney says it'll shut down all its parks. Then I'll be like, okay, now we've got a problem. Because when you talk about economic impact, people coming here from all over the world, and Florida being a tourist-driven area, that would be like a serious sign of, okay, this is really getting mm-hmm. to be a pandemic. So I think that people and organizations should continue to take precautions and do what's right from them. I know the big riding conference that's coming up in San Antonio with AWP, they have been scaling back and canceling and doing things like that. So everyone needs to be cautious, but also have common sense about it and just wash your hands, do what you can do to keep yourself safe.
I've noticed a lot more hand washing lately and people are less. Go ahead, Ann.
I just wanted to interject. I mean, the health impacts are one thing. And I guess my point is more that the economic impacts, I think, are going to be more profound for everybody than possibly the health impacts for most people. You know, it is obviously very scary for people who are elderly, for people who have, you know, autoimmune disorders. But in terms of everybody, I think if there is, you know, if you're shutting down schools, if you're shutting down travel, if you're shutting down festivals, that very quickly starts to be a pocketbook issue for people who might not have a health risk.
Mike.
Yeah, I mean, and that's something that we definitely need to keep an eye on is the volume coming in and out of our ports, the volume coming of people coming in and out of airports, spending money at restaurants, those kind of things. I mean, that's the trickle down effect that an issue like this can have. And it's interesting because it's unfortunate that it takes a virus like this that's new and kind of and unknown for us to be doing things that we probably should be doing during flu season. Anyway, washing our hands, making sure we're,
absolutely. At the same time, the Trump administration has announced millions in an outlay to deal with the coronavirus outbreak around the country. We're also being told, though, that their promise of 1 million coronavirus tests for use this week won't happen. Senator Rick Scott of Florida attended a briefing about this Thursday with health officials and said that the government is still days or even weeks away from sending test kits out, particularly to public health departments like our own Duval County Health Department. And so one reason why Melissa, the patient I mentioned earlier, couldn't get a test is they just might not have enough tests yet to do that. So as we talk about this, we want to hear your thoughts about the local, state, and federal response to coronavirus. It's 549-2937. And we're going to talk about that and other news of the week, along with your calls and tweets. Here's a tweet from Kevin. What many seem to be missing is that just because you have a mild case doesn't mean that the person who contracts the virus from you won't have a far more serious reaction. That's a good point. Mm-hmm. You can be a carrier of this virus and pass it on, Ann, right?
Yeah, and that seems to be the, maybe how this community spread has been happening, with people not necessarily being aware that it was happening. I mean, there's people who probably had it, didn't realize they had it, and obviously that makes for a more troubling contagion because you have all kinds of contacts without maybe taking the precautions you would if you knew.
549-2937. Richard is in Murray Hill. Hi, Richard. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to add to the conversation that, what I feel is getting a short shrift, and that's the failure to predict and prepare for this thing. Anybody in their right mind could have seen, a month ago, if not 2 months ago, that it was time to prepare. But, back on this side of the water, President Trump is eliminating the pandemic advisory team, cutting funds to the CDC, cutting funds to the National Institutes of Health, and even going so far as to change rules at the CDC, allowing their decisions to be made on factors other than science. As recently as day before yesterday, the president went on national TV and lied, assuming that he understands, lied about the death rate from the virus. This is not helping, and it is counter to any good that the administration seems to be trying to do to get ready for the thing. It's been bumbled and fumbled. And you can tell that they're feeling it because Trump felt the need to blame, Barack Obama for the problem. Thank you.
Richard, thanks for the call. The Trump administration has come under heavy criticism for its handling of coronavirus. As I mentioned a minute ago, they just authorized an emergency aid package of $8 billion to better respond to this. Can they turn around public perceptions with a big infusion of spending and more aggressive response that this is not being handled aggressively enough in the United States?
I don't think at this point the Trump administration, people have their feelings about it one way or the other. So if you're against the administration, you're going to be against their policies and have another reason to criticize them, whether they turn it around or not. I think it is worth questioning. Why would you cut the pandemic funding? Why would you make the cuts at the CDC and the NIH? Just because we always know that things like this can happen. But I feel like that the United States in general works on the assumption that because we are somewhat of an isolated superpower country, things that happen there where Asia and Europe touch each other, don't happen here because there's a whole ocean between us on both sides. And we forget that even though, yes, we are an ocean away, people travel and are trying to come here all the time. And it's just, we have to change our perception as an entire nation of, oh, well, that's over there. It can't happen here. And this isn't the first time that we've seen epidemics like this swell up. And then, oh my gosh, what is the United States doing? Swine flu, Ebola, coronavirus. I mean, it keeps happening.
549-2937. John is in Mandarin. Hi, John. Good morning.
Yeah. Hi, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call. And my question is, I have not heard anything really about addressing this issue in Florida's nursing homes, which, as you know, Florida is the nursing home capital probably of the world, not only to the patients of nursing homes, which are mostly elderly patients, but the hundreds of thousands of healthcare practitioners who practice and in and out of the nursing homes and, of course, will be out in the public. I have not heard a whole lot being addressed as far as that issue is concerned.
Yeah.
And I'll take my question off the air.
Thank you, John. You know, Anne, Florida is vulnerable because of our tourism industry and because of our senior population. And how nursing homes and assisted living centers in particular have right to be concerned about this, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's concerning to people of a certain age, too. I'll tell you, my folks are down here right now, and it's been a big topic of conversation. You know, it's affected how we interact, how they interact with my kids even. You know, there's sort of this, like, new normal of kind of a sideways hug. I mean,
right.
You know, and back to the issue of, you know, the money that has been allocated. I mean, just a week ago, this administration was proposing, I think, $2 billion, while Congress was pushing for $8 billion, and now we're at $8 billion, and everybody's in agreement that that might not even be enough. You know, when this began in China, there was reports about how officials' response was more about not necessarily addressing the spread, but kind of concerns about impressions of, you know, how things are being handled. And there's been some question about whether, you know, the motivations at this level have been about economic concerns more than, you know, or impacts on the stock market. And the biggest thing in any pandemic or epidemic is that there is trust of the agencies that are, you know, tasked with responding to it. And that's going to be paramount, I think, in the next couple of weeks. Spending is a big thing, but also just communicating in a way that the public believes that, you know, those who are managing this outbreak are doing so in good faith and telling us what we need to know in a timely fashion.
And that is so important. Here's a tweet about that from Lisa. How does the panel feel about the quality of info coming from official sources? Could state health officials be engaging in more transparency?
Yes.
About this?
Short answer, yes. No one knows anything, and so I feel like they're reluctant to say something, but so many people have questions that I feel like they need to say something.
It's very hard to get information. When you call the local health department, they refer you to the Florida Department of Health, and they don't get back to you. We don't have a lot of information right now.
I mean, I think part of it's probably a lack of process that was existing prior to the coronavirus scare. And then part of it is probably reluctance to share a lot of information that's still kind of fluid moving forward to avoid panic, you know. It's important to remember, and it's ironic that it's strange that it's happening during an election year. So, I mean, that rhetoric can really, you know, can really amp up. We got to make sure that the rhetoric and analysis of the response doesn't actually get in the way of bettering the response as we move forward, because this is an active situation. And it's important that appropriating that $8 billion, it's appropriated in a way that's really going to make a difference and is going to impact the populations that are most affected.
Yancey tweets the show.
But it is a political season, and there is going to be political implications for everything that happens with this disease. And it's something to be aware of. I don't know that it, you know, obviates what's happening in any way, but it's something to think about, because there are going to be people with political interests in outcomes and impressions and impacts.
Absolutely. Here is a tweet from Yancey. My husband has to take anti-rejection drugs after a kidney transplant. This is not only about people getting sick. It's that healthcare may not be available for your mom's heart surgery, my son's car crash injuries. People have a lot of concerns. We will continue to follow it, but we're going to move on and discuss some of the other big stories from the week. If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable here on First Coast Connect with Ann Schindler, Mike Mendenhall, Nakisha Williams, and yours truly. And your calls and tweets. Call us up right now. It's 549-2937. Because also making headlines this week, we learned the city of Jax is taking steps to try to combat sex trafficking. A new city law will impose tighter regulations on adult entertainment businesses. In this city, that includes requiring strippers to be at least 21 years old rather than as young as 18. Young women are trafficked through strip clubs. Mayor Lenny Curry says he will sign this bill, and he hopes it will cut off a pipeline of trafficking young girls from strip clubs into the sex trade. Nakisha, in addition to raising the age of strippers from 18 to 21, the city will require all adult entertainment performers to carry work ID cards. And so this is a way, I think, that they've hit upon through legislation to try to at least make a dent in the human trafficking scourge that we see here in Florida. We're one of the most heavily populated states when it comes to human and sex and labor trafficking.
I think it's a great step forward. I have no objections to this, raising the age and having the performer at work identification cards. For every like Cinderella story that we see out of the strip club, like the Players Club or Cardi B, you see the underbelly of what mm-hmm. really can happen in the sex trade. Mm-hmm. And it can go from, yes, maybe you're just stripping just because that's all you can do to get work, to you can become trafficked. And so I think, you know, protecting women, no matter what their age is or their reason is for going into this work, if that's what they choose to do, we should try to protect them at all costs.
Yeah. Mike Mendenhall, the Dolores Barweaver Policy Center works on these issues. They applaud them, but say that survivors need more support and law enforcement needs more training, along with social service agencies. That this is a good start, but we need a lot more.
Yeah, I mean, and I think if you ask anybody in the city, they'll tell you that this is a good start, but they do need more. Council members Leanna Cumber and Tommy Azuri really pushed this legislation through. I think another important note in this legislation is it also holds the operators of these clubs accountable. They need to report sex trafficking and make sure that it's not happening in their establishments. I saw some reports saying that there was a possible fear of retribution amongst these from the traffickers themselves, from these club owners. Hopefully this legislation will alleviate that and give them that mandate to report.
Here's a tweet from a listener, Ann. The mayor and the administration are out of touch. Why put this issue on the backs of the women by raising the age? How about going after the sellers and buyers exploiting and trafficking vulnerable youth?
Well, I mean, it's a complicated issue. I will say, you know, it does help if this is not a destination city for underage strippers. And I think that was the concern, was that because other cities had this age requirement, and Jacksonville just basically had a walk-up, you know, stripping code that allowed you to come from anywhere and walk on stage that night and perform without any, you know, any checks or balances.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I mean, I personally would have some concerns about requiring strippers to have licenses that identify them as such, and then have that information, all that personal information, you know, on file at the sheriff's office and at the strip club. It doesn't take much for me to imagine that information could be accessed or misused in some insidious ways. So I know that it's designed to protect the women, but I personally have some fears about how that information could be used or misused, and it just seems a little bit strange too to have to have that license. I mean, that could compromise people, I would think, too. Mm. if they're not public about their work. I don't know. It's new to me in some ways, but I do think that it's a good faith effort, and it probably will cut down on some of the younger women coming here and, you know, from other places possibly being trafficked and then pushed onto stage to perform.
It's 549-2937. Let us know your thoughts about all this. Jeff is from Argyle. Hi, Jeff. Good morning.
Hi. My comment goes to talk about how some of these proposed changes are a little bit unrealistic. I'm a partner in one of those places.
Which one?
Speaking of, I'm not going to say. But the thing about it is, it's like twofold. Like on one fold, we're talking about protecting the girls. When you have a place where they can come safely and do their work, some of these girls feed families with this money. And it's kind of like when they closed down Backstage. Now you'll be sending those who can't meet those qualifications to the streets, which is way more dangerous.
Well, Jeff, the primary age that young women are trafficked is 14 to 18. Can you honestly say no young women have been trafficked in your establishment? Do you know that for sure?
Yes, they have to fill out applications. They have to fill out just like any other job.
But you didn't answer my question. How do you know for sure that no teenage girls in your club have been trafficked? How do you know that for sure?
We take the ID, all the information. How does McDonald's know that their workers are of age? The same way any other business does.
Well, why is it a bad thing to raise the age to 21? You have to be 21 to do a lot of things in this country.
18 is the age of consent. 18 is the age of adulthood. From 18 to 21, these girls that were gainfully employed in these establishments, where are they to go now to replace that income?
All right, Jeff, thanks for the call. What about Jeff's comment?
Well,
I
guess, you know.
Did you want to weigh in?
I was just going to say, the club owners are not going to like this bill. I mean, they don't. And it comes with some additional costs to process these new licenses. It also comes with this new right to enter component where the sheriff's office doesn't need any reason. You know, they don't need a warrant. And I do think that's probably going to be legally challenged. Strip clubs are nothing if not litigious when it comes to, you know, new laws that impact them. There's been a number of, like, costly, high-profile lawsuits on a number of levels in the state of Florida. And they have some attorneys on retainer that I think are probably going to go for that pretty quickly, because I'm not sure that there's sufficient, you know, public safety to just erase Fourth Amendment rights for these clubs. But I mean, obviously, if they're losing their contingent of 18 to 21-year-old women, that is a significant impact on these businesses. A lot of their strippers are in that age group.
Okay, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, you know, regardless of the additional regulations on these businesses, I mean, it should be incumbent already on these business owners to ensure that minors are not being, or anyone are not being trafficked through their establishments. So
that partner said that he was making sure everyone was of age, filling out an application.
And, you know, then one additional step to verify that shouldn't be an issue if there's no one being trafficked in this club.
Nikisha.
Saying that raising the age puts the burden on the backs of the women who are just trying to make a living, I just completely disagree with. My issue, I think, with anything is that, you know, when we see trafficking victims, how many times have they been arrested and charged with prostitution before they are identified as a victim and then given the social services that they need? I think raising the age will maybe help in that area, because then we can begin to see victims as victims and not as criminals. I think that's where our justice system fails. As far as the club owners, whoever wants to strip, if they want to strip at 18 and they still want to strip at 21, they'll go strip. I don't think that you'll have trouble funding and finding entertainment for your establishment. So I think doing what is possible to protect women, reduce trafficking, and have victims get the support and the services that they need needs to be done. And if it's an inconvenience to your business, then that's the cost of doing business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Nikisha's right. I mean, there has been a big change in just in the last few years from, you know, there's something that we widely called women prostitutes, and we now call them sex traffic victims. It's just a changing conversation around the sex trade and you know, things of that kind.
Okay, and with all of that said, more news to get into from the week. 549-2937. Let's talk about JEA for a minute. The utility is looking to start constructing its new downtown headquarters next month. Also, the five unions representing JEA employees now say they formed a new entity to keep watch over the future of JEA. It's called Northeast Florida United. Mike, let's begin with the headquarters news, which you covered in the Daily Record.
Yeah, so, and you know, they're going to be, they're hoping to break ground in late April. Now, the land deal that the city made with Ryan Companies US, the developer, and which will be the building owner of this new headquarters, has not been finalized. We are expecting that by the end of the month. You know, the building itself, you know, there's been a lot of talk as to you know, whether or not you know, this was the right path for JEA to move forward on. Nelson Mullins, who's in a law firm who actually did some discovery research and presented it to the city during the investigation into former JEA CEO Aaron Zahn. They actually said that the development of this new building was used as a bargaining chip to sell JEA because the threat was that if the utility wasn't sold to a private operator, they would be downsizing, and then they would move JEA out of downtown, which is not what city leaders wanted to see. So the fact that this is moving forward, that the groundbreaking is happening, you know, some see the end of JEA as a relief. Others are still skeptical.
Well, and as that is happening, as I mentioned, there are five unions that represent the workers of JEA. They had a little get-together last night at Intuition Ale Works, and they titled it JEA is Still Ours. And they, the five union stewards all stood up in front of the crowd and said, we are now a new group, Northeast Florida United. Representatives from the advocacy group OurJax.com were also there, along with several members, current and former, of the Jacksonville City Council. A bipartisan showing on council, basically celebrating that JEA remains a public utility.
Yeah, I mean, slimmest of fortunes, it seems, you know. I mean, it really, that was on such a fast track. And I think that, you know, the building is some people are celebrating that, you know, the new board is reviewing some of the contracts. I mean, some of these things that are happening now were set in motion, you know, by the previous board, obviously, and given all the concerns with transparency, you know, some decisions of questionable ethics, a lot of these things, I think, are just always going to have a little bit of a cloud of suspicion around them, because they all were set in motion under the same set of circumstances by the same set of people, and some of them fast-tracked in a strange way. So, I think that obviously a lot of relief that from the people of JEA that they're not moving on a train single track towards sale, but a lot of these other things that are happening still have attached to them some suspicion and some questions.
Yeah. Certainly the rank and file employees at JEA are very happy about what's happened. There are seven new proposed board members, Nikisha, that Mayor Curry has nominated that the city council would theoretically approve. And the JEA board is going to decide the fate of these no-bid contracts that the utility had approved when they were negotiating to sell JEA. So that's something that's still happening as well.
I feel like JEA is trying to change the narrative of 2019 any way possible. But I feel like it all comes back to just what is happening. That's what they show the public face and the private face. And those two still have not lined up for what is supposed to be a publicly owned utility. So, yes, we've got seven new board members who have been nominated by the mayor. But then we've got these three contracts that are no bid that we don't really have a lot of information about. There's still all the skepticism around what happened with the sale, the investigation that could go federal. And then this whole new shiny headquarters that's going to be next to the courthouse that goes back to maybe it was a bargaining chip for the sale that no one knew about. So it's like JEA needs to find a way to align what it's doing unilaterally across his business practices so that it doesn't always seem like, you know, you show one hand to hide the other.
Hmm. Interesting. Mike, you know, whether or not JEA had decided to try to sell, the plans for that new downtown building had been in the works for quite some time. And I think anyone that's been in the JEA Tower would see that they need a new headquarters. They need a new building.
Yeah, it's. I mean, the building itself is in need of serious renovations. I had one former JEA executive tell me that it could be up to $40 million to actually renovate that space. So it's. You could argue either way. I think the development of that building actually dates back, I believe, all the way to 2017 is kind of when they kind of started working on that process. So, I mean, it's been in the works for quite a long time. But JEA is not actually going to own that building. They're going to be leasing it from Orion companies. Which they actually signed that lease. They approved that lease in July at the same time that they approved the ITN, which goes to Ann's point why there's probably a bit of a cloud over this project.
Yeah, sure. Now, speaking of buildings, let's talk about the other big news from the week. Lot J. Everybody listening to the show, you've been following the plans to develop around TIAA Bankfield. Well, this week, developers shared some updated renderings, new images of what they want to do at Lot J by the NFL Stadium. This is ShotKan's proposed $2.5 billion Lot J and Shipyards development. The company doing this says it's a starting point for two decades of development in the downtown sports and entertainment district. We're talking about everything from office space to a live entertainment venue to condos to a new marina on the water. Very fancy renderings. Will they all come to fruition? Will we actually see all this? Jacksonville's seen so many renderings through the years for buildings that never get built. So let's try to think positive. But as we talk about Lot J at the same time, the demolition of the Hart Bridge ramps got underway this week. Those ramps are coming down in order to theoretically make Lot J more successful. So if you're driving through this area, you will see that they will soon be demolishing those ramps. That is going to bring changes to this weekend's Gate River Run starting line. So if you're running in the gate this Saturday or Sunday, is it on Saturday?
Saturday.
Be mindful. There's going to be a new route for the first mile of the race because you will cross that green monster, the Hart Bridge, but then there will be a little bit of change in your route. But Mike, you've really been covering Lot J. You saw these renderings. People can read more in the Daily Record and also at WJCT.org. What was your reaction?
Well, one of the most notable things is they've increased the residential density in the initial phase of Lot J. They're now talking like 700 like residential units, both mid-rise and high-rise, and they really shifted the corporate office aspect of it to phase two, which Mark Lamping actually told me about in an interview in January, which would be an additional $200 million on top of the proposed $500 million Lot J development. So, and then if you look at the renderings too, which was actually delivered in a speech to the Mennonac Club by Zed Smith, who's the chief operating officer at the Cordish Companies, which is the developer working with ShotKan on the project. And they actually showed future residential north of Lot J. And then they also showed future possible development in the shipyards that we hadn't seen before. So they really are planning ahead to the future on this.
Ann Schindler, what about this quote we heard from the Cordish Companies? That's the company doing all the construction, that we can enjoy two decades of development around the Jaguars Stadium.
Well, hurrah. I mean, you know, that's where you and I work, Melissa. And,
yeah, I know, exactly. Well, we have a little stake in this since we work right here.
Yeah. I mean, I am personally a little uncertain about the residential boost component. I think it's, you know, nice renderings, and we all perhaps maybe take the renderings with a grain of salt, knowing how the flex field came out somewhat different than the renderings. But residential in the middle of a sports complex, I'm not sure how much, I think that really is a popular thing. I mean, people do enjoy a downtown experience, but these are literally sandwiched between the stadium and the baseball grounds. I mean, I don't know that that's necessarily a place that people want to make their home, but that's, you know, just maybe me being a little skeptical of that component of it. But obviously their renderings are, you know, they're glossy, they're impressive. I think people are going to be excited about the idea of development on a bunch of empty lots.
Yeah, sure. And when you look at the water component too, you know, a fancy new marina and promenade out into the St. John's River, it activates the waterfront. At the same time, Nikisha, development on the river is getting a closer look from the City Council's new resiliency committee. The city is late to the game on this, very late, but they are starting to look at how we should maybe change building codes in the future so that we don't build so close to water, because we've seen the vulnerability.
Yeah, living on water is very beautiful. I'm sure it's really great. I don't live near water, but from what I told, I mean, it's a great thing and it's a nice luxury to have. But when you're in a city, in a state that's surrounded by water and hurricane season is a very real threat often, and the river rises and it floods, I think we do need to be realistic about where we're building and what it's going to take, what the cost to the environment will be to build this new marina and these new high rises to make sure that there aren't any corners cut and when it comes to safety. And then my other concern, you mentioned that they're going to be building maybe north of Lot J, which makes me wonder about what's going to happen to the existing community that's already north of Lot J and on the other side of the Hart Bridge, because when development will be great for downtown, it'll be a great influx in people and in the economy and in jobs, but there will also be a cost that we're not talking about to the neighborhood and the community that's already there that has been in want and in need of development for years. And has not gotten it.
Thank you for pointing that out. And we're almost to our break, but finally, it is our lightning round as we talk about other news from the week, beginning with the trial you're up in Georgia covering Ann Schindler. Tell what's the latest?
Well, we actually had a verdict yesterday, surprising verdict that was split. This is a civil case, but the allegations are of child sexual abuse, and it's a very prominent coach in South Georgia who runs a PAX Karate in Kingsland and still coaches. These are seven adult men who claim, and a jury found, that four of them were sexually molested as children.
Okay.
Surprisingly, they're not going to get any damages because the jury chose not to award compensatory damages.
Wow.
They wanted to award punitive damages, but they can't without awarding compensatory. So it's sort of a strange outcome for these plaintiffs.
Thank you, Ann. Quickly, Nikisha, you have a one-woman show.
Yes, my one-woman show opened last night at Babs Lab in Riverside. It's entitled Lessons We Were Never Taught, just exploring all the things that women go through in life that you wish you would have learned before you got into them, and it runs through Sunday.
Mike.
Yeah, so talk about development in the sports complex. We just found or just unveiled new renderings for the Doro, which is a redevelopment of the Doro Furniture Company building.
Look there on the Jags Daily Record.
Right.
And I want to take a moment to honor the late Judy Wells, a former Times Union journalist and an amazing lady and travel writer. She appeared on this show for years. Judy passed away after a trip to Morocco, so she went out doing what she loved, traveling the world. R.I.P. to Judy Wells. And thank you, Ann Schindler, Mike Mendenhall, and Nikisha Williams. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you,
Melissa.
Up next, celebrating the silver anniversary of the Concours d'Elegance. That's next.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm. Malignant mesothelioma. Asbestos dust causes this cancer. Learn more from board-certified civil trial specialist Wayne Hogan at waynehogan.law.
Congaree & Penn offers an elevated farm setting for private events. With all-encompassing farm-to-table culinary service, the farm's acres are a unique backdrop for special occasions. More at congareeandpenn.com.
Vistar Credit Union, focused on offering services for its members from checking and savings to loans and health savings accounts. Vistar, we never forget that it's your money. Information 777-6000 or vistarcu.org.
I'm Peter Sagal. You know how you won't contract coronavirus? By listening to the radio. Unless you're in a cruise ship, in which case, it's too late. Join us for this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday morning at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
3, 2, 1, 0, and liftoff.
Do you want to be an astronaut? I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, NASA is opening up job applications looking to hire a bunch of new astronauts. What does it take to qualify? We'll talk about if you have the right stuff on the next Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Today at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
A Super Tuesday surge makes Joe Biden think he'll be the one to take on Donald Trump.
I will beat him, period. He's even risked his presidency because he doesn't want to face me.
California declares a state of emergency, and a tornado kills dozens in Tennessee. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's the Friday News Roundup. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, the 25th annual Amelia Concours d'Elegance, happening at the Ritz-Carlton on Amelia Island, got underway yesterday, and it runs through Sunday. Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times Union has been going to the Concours for years. He's live up there on the phone for us from Amelia Island. Dan, it's their silver anniversary.
Yes, I've been coming all 25 years, and talking about silver, I'm standing in front of a 789-horsepower McLaren Senna, as folks are pushing a replica, a Purosangue replica of a Type 35B Bugatti. It's just amazing what's at here in the forecourt of the hotel right now. Roger Penske was out this morning with Bill Warner, who's the chairman and founder. Roger, of course, is the honoree this year, and there'll be about 30 of his race cars that he raced, where his teams have raced and won in, including 5 Indy cars, and some of the cars that he actually raced and won in, including a homecoming of sorts, Hubert Brundage, who started Brumos Motors and did Brumos Racing. A Porsche that he won in, that Penske won in back in the 60s in the Bahamas, is going to be here.
Excellent. Well, so for anyone who loves these beautiful cars and autos, I mean, it's just such a special weekend. There's also a big charitable component. Can you tell us about the foundation?
Well, the foundation, $3.5 million plus that has been donated to Community Hospice, to Spina Bifida of Jacksonville, to Shop with Cops. In fact, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer John Oates is here with one of his race cars, and it is actually going up for auction at RM Sotheby's, and all those proceeds will go to the foundation as well. It's second time that Mr. Oates has been here, and he's judging on the field on Sunday because he's a car nut.
Like you. I can't believe you've gone, yep. You've gone to all 25 of these. Is that you haven't missed a one?
I haven't missed a one, and I've enjoyed it. I've watched it from a small show with a little over 100 to the one that monsooned, but he still had 5,000 people when they put the cars in the ballroom here at the Ritz-Carlton, to now an expected 300 cars and 20 or 30,000 people on this weekend. And right now we've got manufacturer support from Lexus, Porsche, McLaren, Mercedes-Benz, AMG. They're all here giving you test drives. Cadillac is a major sponsor this year. They've got a ton of their CTS-Vs. It's just amazing the kind of corporate support that comes here, and people from all walks of life who come in, from the hot rodders who will get to see the Rolling Bones hot rod collection, to those classic car lovers who are going to see the Bugattis and the Bentleys and the Rolls Royces from the 19-teens and 20s.
Sure. You know, people really do come in from all over the world. Just yesterday, we were able to meet Lord Carnarvon. He is the owner of Highclere Castle, the British stately home. Yeah, that's the home, of course, where Downton Abbey was filmed. And he is at the Concours marketing his Highclere Castle gin. We'll have his interview up shortly. But this has a global appeal, doesn't it?
It does. And there are people who are flying in from all over the world. There will be more than a dozen of previous honorees here from England and America. These are famous race car drivers who have been here with their cars. They have a special dinner tonight for them. And then Penske himself, who just bought the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, who just bought the IndyCar Series, and whose NASCAR, IndyCar, IMSA team, and Australian Supercars won their respective championships last year. Not too bad.
Very cool. Now, let's talk about the coronavirus. Everything is going on as normal with this event, but yes, they are also working with local and state health authorities.
Yeah, then they sent out the usual alert to me. If you're sick, don't come here. Wash your hands. They have lots of stations with disinfectant around. I noticed some hotel staff serving food are wearing gloves. So it's just a be careful here. Almost everything is outdoors except for the seminars and the auctions. They're just advising be careful. And if you're sick, don't come here.
Good advice. Well, have fun, Dan. I know it's a big weekend and lots of fun for you. And our own station manager, David Luckin, loves it too. So
I just waved at him. He's across the way.
Have fun, guys. That's Dan Scanlon of the Times Union. It's the Amelia Concours d'Elegance today through Sunday at the Ritz-Carlton Amelia Island and their golf club, ameliaconcours.org, for more. And here's a little music just for Dan Scanlon to close with, Little Red Corvette. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for being with us. And make sure to tune in at noon today for the Florida Roundup. That's our live statewide call-in show, looking at the biggest issues from all across Florida from the week. Have a great weekend wherever your car takes you. And we'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday morning. We'll connect with you then.
I saw all the pictures of the jockeys that were there before me. Believe it or not, I started to worry. I wondered if I had enough class. But it was Saturday night. Try to tame a little red love machine.